Welcome to Stories from the Pitch, a podcast dedicated to creating a living social history book about street performing and some of the crazy characters who populate this world.
It matters not the job you've got.
The greatest icons of the street performing world.
As long as you do it well.
Never been so excited in my whole life.
Things that are made by plans well laid, the test of time will tell.
I knew I was going to get a little flack from each one of you.
You cannot count or know the amount.
I can do anything.
Or the value of a man by the show displayed or the beauty made by the touch of the juggler's hand.
Because no one really cares about me.
I am the Butterfly Man, and I thank you for your kind attention.
So, you're going to be a street performer. Basically, you're going to suck for a really long time. Once you just get comfortable with that and it doesn't define who you are, as long as you define yourself as a person who keeps waking up and going back out there, you're fine. You're on your way.
It literally took years for Lindsay Lindbergh to develop her Mamalou strong woman character, and there were plenty of challenges along the way. She relates the first year of doing shows to free-falling as she attempted to navigate the uncharted course of building a show that didn't rely on juggling, magic, or a romance-based chick show equation. Instead, she took the harder path of developing her show around an original concept, which was initially a much bigger risk, but which has resulted in much bigger rewards. I often hear older performers saying that the new generation is just following a formulaic approach to their work. Although there is certainly a lot of that out there, I wanted to highlight someone who's been in the game for less than a decade and who has deliberately chosen to innovate. The fact that Lindsay has also made some huge contributions to making this project a reality also made her an easy choice. In episode 20, while Lindsay interviewed John Feely, he joked that perhaps he'd end up in Austin, and that's exactly what happened. So we thought it would be fun to switch the roles around and have John interview Lindsay. Even though she is a strong woman, John was able to coax some lovely humor, vulnerability, and surprises out of Lindsay, as you'll hear in some really hilarious anecdotes in today's episode.
Welcome to another episode of Stories from the Pitch. My name is John Feely, and I'm sitting here in Austin, Texas, with Lindsay Lindbergh, otherwise known as Mamalou.
So, we're going to talk, aren't we, about performing and street performing. For those people that don't know you, you're not a juggler and you're not a magician. Which is what 90% of these people who work on the street are. What is your act?
I am a strong woman.
So explain what your act is, essentially. If people have never seen it, what is your act?
The act is that I do legitimate, old-school feats of strength. Things like ripping telephone books in half, crushing apples with my bicep, one-arm push-ups, one-arm pull-ups, all sorts of crazy feats. Wow, and at the end I sum it up and get some money for it.
But none of it is gimmicked. None of it is fake, because you can get the same effect by faking these tricks, right? But you choose not to.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, that's kind of been one of the hallmarks of what it is that I do and propose to do, is that I am kind of a medium-looking woman. I don't look extremely strong. I don't look super fit. But the whole thing is that I do everything 100% legitimately. So at the end of the show, I can say, hey, if I can do these amazing feats of strength, what kinds of awesome and amazing things do you think you're capable of doing that maybe you didn't think so before?
So your approach, perhaps unlike a lot of people, although there's humor involved, you're not overtly a comedy act, are you?
No, not really.
There's humor there, but you're not trying to do gags.
No. I think at the beginning, I watched so many performers and saw that this was what you do. You have these taglines and beat, 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 laugh goes here. And for a long time, beat myself up because that just wasn't what I was good at. I memorized jokes. I memorized things that I thought were going to be funny. I wrote my own jokes, and it just kind of turned out that I realized that you have to listen to what the audience wants you to be, not what you think they want you to be. And after a while, I just came to the point where the audience was telling me they like it when I'm sincere, they like it when I'm earnest and wholesome and just kind of this good-natured gal. And so I finally stopped trying to force these jokes and funny moments, and then the truth was is that I'm a funny, ridiculous character, and that has been way better than trying to put together gags.
So where did it all begin? Because for most people who do a juggling act or a magic act, it's something they've learned before they even performed, and then they take that skill and they perform it. it's not an obvious thing, is it? Strong woman tricks. So where did it begin?
Well, I was an aerialist first. I was a clown, actually, at the very, very beginning. I was a clown. And I did that with a theater company in New York for about 5 years. So that was always this background part of me. And then I became a burlesque performer and an aerialist and moved to Canada, kind of ran away from New York and normal life there, and decided that I wanted to go and study trapeze and tissue, and I wanted to go be a circus performer. And somewhere along the path, I actually got distracted. I was in Toronto, and I was taking a clown workshop with Sue Morrison. And in that clown workshop, I met, actually through that, I guess Zero Gravity was hosting the space where the workshop was held. So I started meeting all of these street performers in the Toronto area. Duke Dreamer was in my clown class, and I met this guy, Brant Matthews, and I met Eli Vendisky, who runs Zero Gravity. And so all of these people, oh, and Scott Free.
So I started meeting all of these people who were buskers. It was the very first time I started seeing this was a thing, because everywhere I'd been before, I hadn't seen people working on the street unless it was like little table magic stuff.
Before you went to New York, you were originally from Kansas City.
Originally from the throbbing metropolis.
Yeah,
of Kansas. So the thing actually that started getting really fascinating to me is I was hanging out with these buskers and going and drinking pitchers of beer and talking stories and I remember hearing these stories of all these other buskers. I mean, talk about crazy characters who populate this world. It was so true. I'm listening from the outside in and hearing stories about Tupon. I remember stories about Tupon and just thinking, that can't be true, hearing that this guy makes more money than you can even imagine, and hearing these little quotes and stories and quips, and I just thought, this is not true, they're exaggerating. And then I finally meet Tupon at the Kingston Buskers Festival one year, and I was his assistant, and I couldn't stop laughing because it was absolutely true. You know, it was the first time I realized that there's this world full of crazy people who really do travel, work, perform and do all of this, and they have this beautiful existence that's outside of the regular world.
So when and where was the first time you ever decided to go out and do a show?
The first time, well, I'm a very stubborn and pretty opinionated person, and it probably gets in my way a lot. I think I had seen a street show once I was in Toronto, and for all the talk that I had heard, it sounded so noble, and it sounded like the most genuine, legitimate way to make money that I had ever heard. It was kind of one of these things where, you know, if you're good, people give you money and you've earned it. And if you suck, you're going to starve. So therefore, why not get on out there and you'll know in real time whether you're good or not. And you're not cheating anybody out of any money because they've already seen the product before they decide to pay you or not. But then I actually went and saw a show, and it was... the jokes were so bad, and the tricks were just so kind of, you know, if you come from a circus background, they're so mediocre, that I actually was like, oh, fuck no, I'm not doing that. And so I kind of became obstinately like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be a busker. And then there came this moment where I guess I had been at this point. I auditioned for a circus school in France when I was back in New York, actually a couple of them, and I didn't make it. And I really didn't deserve to make it because those people have been going to circus high school. They've been training for years and years. You know, they've already been put on that path. And I'm this 24-year-old who's just decided that she wants to dedicate her life to something less ordinary.
Because before this, you had a proper job. Before you'd done this, you had at some point had...
Yeah, yeah.
Worked in an office and done a job.
Yeah, I was always a performer on the side, right. But it was always... my hobby. It meant that all my extra work money went into buying props, went into renting theaters or rehearsal space. It was definitely a hobby. No money ever was made as a performer. And so, yeah, for 3 years before I left New York, worked in an office, worked as an assistant.
And you ran away from that to go to circus school.
Well, that was the audition, trying to find a way to go live in another country, learn to speak another language, and study something that mattered to me. I had actually just finished up college. I went back to school and got my degree just because I decided it was something important to me to just do and have out of the way and feel like I'd accomplished something. And after I graduated, there's this kind of momentum where you feel like you've already got it down. You know the routine. You know how to study. You know how to write papers. And I thought, shouldn't I just go ahead and apply for a master's program? And I had and still do have the feeling that eventually I'd like to go back and be a college professor. But this idea of actually going through and being able to teach college by the time I was 30 was frightening. Just, I could see the entire course of my life being mapped out. And you know, after the age of 30, 32, there would be no more changes or surprises. It would just be go to school every day and grade papers. And not that it's not what I want to do eventually, but I felt like my soul got crumpled up like a piece of paper. And I just decided that, you know, I've already done the responsible thing. It's time to go live. It's time to go find that thing. Like, what is it that gives your life purpose? And so that's when I started auditioning for the schools. Okay, so then I didn't make it into the circus schools, even though I paid my way over to France twice to go to these auditions. And again, I legitimately didn't deserve to make it in, but I was just kind of on a hope and a prayer, maybe some kind of, you know, affirmative action quota that they had to have so many international students. Like, somehow I thought maybe I'd get in, and I didn't. But it came down to this idea that solidified in my head, which is I don't need permission in order to perform. I don't need somebody to tell me I'm good enough to come into their school and learn in order to validate me as a performer. Basically, all I need to do is get out there and perform.
So you'd seen people performing on the street, but because the first one you saw was
kind of meh.
Yeah, no yeah. good. You kind of went, okay, this is not for me.
Yeah, it scared me because I didn't want to dedicate so much time and effort to something that was schlocky, you know, in my head. But then it changed because I realized in talking to these people again and more drinks and more, you know, pubs, I started hearing more stories about other people, and I realized that actually some of my very favorite performers that I had ever seen in New York were buskers. And I had no idea.
But you hadn't seen them perform on the street in New York?
No. I'd seen them only do stage shows.
So who are we talking about?
So Clark and Sylvia were doing Planet Banana at the time, and I had seen that a couple of times. We didn't know who they were. We just happened upon this show, and it blew my mind. It was so present and available, and it was just those moments when someone's standing in front of an entire audience and you feel that connection between the person on stage and every person in the room. It was that full circle of connection. That show blew me away. Every time they were in town and doing a show, I made sure to be there. John and Anne, the Daredevil Chickens, also made me really excited as performers, too. They were amazing.
But these were people that you saw doing shows indoors.
Indoors.
And later realized that they'd learned their stuff outdoors.
Yeah, exactly. So once I realized that these people who had really excited me about performance again, that these people honed their art on the street, that's when I started going, okay, I'm going to do this. And I realized, too, that it's only what you put into it. At no point did I ever want to do what everybody else was doing. It just seemed like a waste.
But inevitably, the first show you do, first of all, it's going to be terrible. And it's going to be in some way derivative, isn't it? Because you're going to have seen people do stuff and go, okay, I'll do that or I won't do that. I'll do the opposite of that. So what was the first show you did?
I approached what I was going to do in my show very cerebrally. And I think it's because I had just gotten out of school. I sat down at a coffee shop, Jet Fuel Coffee in Toronto, where they make this crazy coffee that actually makes you see the future.
Can we just do a legal disclaimer? Canadian coffee does not make you see the future. Your mileage may vary. People are going to be flooding into Canada because they think they can get clairvoyant coffee.
Well, you can. So I thought about just all of my strengths. What do I come from? What do I do? What do I do well? And I realized kind of there that I was stronger than most people that I knew, let alone most girls. And so it just kind of came this idea of being a strong woman.
And this is because you'd done aerial. And so you developed muscles from doing the aerial things. So you had these muscles and you realized you were a bit stronger than the average girl, but you'd never done...
I'd never done any kinds of feats of strength at all.
But that was the first thing you did when you performed, was you went, I'm going to do...
Yeah, it was the very, very first thing I decided I was going to do. So I just made a list of things I thought I could maybe do. Once I came up with, yes, I'm going to be a strong woman, this list of like, well, what do I think I could accomplish?
So what did you have in your head? If you thought of a strong person, what did you think of? I guess the classic things would be ripping a phone book in half.
Mm-hmm. And bending metal bars.
Exactly. But you'd never ripped a phone book in half. You'd never bent a metal bar. You just thought, I'll do it because they do it on the cartoons.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right.
I'm pretty ballsy.
Yeah.
It seems ridiculous to me now, but at the time, I don't know, you just do things because somehow you don't believe that you can't do them. And so you just do.
Yeah, no, but that's one of the symptoms of youth, isn't it? Is that you think, well, why can't I? I've got clairvoyant coffee. I might as well do things that are impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So the first things you did, you ripped a phone book in half
mm-hmm.
in the first show.
Yeah, in the first show.
Ripped a phone book in half.
I bent metal bars.
Right.
And, oh God, the other thing that seemed like a really good idea at the time was crushing eggs with my hands.
Let's just be clear about this. There is a principle which says if you take an egg and hold it between your thumb and your fingers with the pointy end or the base of the egg, no matter how much pressure you put on the egg, it won't break. And there is some scientific...
Yeah, it's about domes. It's about the architectural perfection of
absolutely.
A dome.
Absolutely. However, you didn't quite understand this principle fully.
Well, I had read it in a kid's science blog somewhere. Here's
it's
the problem.
It's as vicarious a piece of I read it in a child's blog. So you didn't quite understand the intricacies... of egg shape dynamics and strength and
no.
You read this piece of information and it got filtered through your coffee fueled clairvoyance as eggs cannot break essentially.
The one that I read said that if you put an egg in the center of your palm and you grip all of your fingers around it, as long as you keep that pressure constant and all the fingers are pushing at the same rate, then the egg can't break.
But we found out, didn't we? Very quickly.
Well, the truth is that, I don't know, again, overconfidence leads to disaster. Let me just say, I know that for a fact.
Well, overconfidence combined with...
Not practicing ahead
no,
of
zero
time.
Preparation, to be fair, is the correct equation, isn't it?
That is the correct equation. Equals, in my very first show, I go out with a dozen eggs, and I've bent my metal bar, and I say, and for my next feat of strength, and then I go into this whole long exposition about the perfection, the shape of the egg, and then how it will be impossible for a mere mortal man to crush this egg, but not for Mama Lou, strong woman. So I get a guy up from the audience, and granted, I have probably 20 to 30 people there, tops. This is the peak of the show for me at this point.
And you were working on a sidewalk. You weren't working on a proper pitch. You
no, this was dirty. This yeah. was hardcore dirty. Early spring. I think it was the 1st of May or something. And it was Queen Street in this small part where the sidewalk gets just a little bit bigger outside of the Lululemon. So you've got people mingling with the trash cans and the recycling because that's just where there was enough space to even squeeze off a show. So this was hardcore. So I find some guy who's smiling, and I get him to come up and help me out. And I hand him an egg, and I tell him that no matter how hard he tries, he will never be able to break this egg. And then
I just say, you were so confident, even though there's zero preparation, you were so confident that you'd actually made yourself a little gimmick. Because clearly, putting an egg in your fist and closing your fist around it, it's not going to damage the integrity of the egg.
It was impossible, right?
So you created a little gimmick,
which
was basically a thumb tip with a nail, right?
Yeah, with a thumbtack through it.
You're right.
Right. At the beginning of Mama Lou, I really probably did not have the strength to do any of these feats of strength legitimately. So I did have gimmicks. So, yeah, I created this little bit of a thumb tip that had a tack in it. And the idea was then when I squashed it, of course it would explode with gusto and I would look amazing. But this is, again, my first street show, and I didn't have anything planned out. And so the guy goes to squeeze it, and what I've learned now at the end of all of this time is that if you give a man a challenge to do, pride combined with standing in front of his friends and that kind of pressure will make him do amazing things. So you better make damn well sure that this is going to be nearly impossible for this man.
But also, if you give him a challenge as simple as break this egg, he's going to do
not
it.
That hard. No. It's not super human.
No, no.
No, so
it's barely human.
So he took the egg in his hand, and within 2 seconds, he squashed that egg all, and it goes not just all over the street, it goes all over him and his jacket, and it's still springtime, and so he's wearing his mild winter jacket. And
you were surprised. You were surprised by this.
I was shocked.
And you didn't have a towel to give him?
I didn't have a towel. I didn't have anything prepared. I didn't have any, like, cover lines, because it was... Because
it said in the child's blog that there was no chance of this egg breaking.
There was little to no chance of this happening at all. And so, to try to cover, I just kind of looked at him and I kind of stroked at his coat to wipe off some of the stuff and I apologized. And I said, I bet you can't do it again.
It's always good to have a line like that to get you out of a situation.
And so I give him another egg, and now at this point I'm determined, but of course my gimmick isn't working because, I don't know, it's just because gimmicks don't work. That's why I realized I had to learn how to do these things legitimately. My little tack was slipping all around the edge of the eggshell, and it just was a disaster. Finally, I squirt my egg, and of course now my egg's gone onto him too. His hand's so slippery, there's no way he can grab hold of it. And so then, yeah, I've squashed my egg, and I'm like, ha-ha!
And you've got about 20 onlookers. Let's not call them an audience. Let's call them...
Who now hate me.
Yeah, exactly. But luckily you had a finale.
Luckily, I had a finale.
To save the day. Because when you've taken a serious percentage of your audience by removing one person and covered them in egg...
I know.
You need to save the day.
I know.
So what did you have?
So I went ahead and broadcasted, please don't leave because I have yet to rip an entire telephone book in half. So again, at the very, very beginning, for the first 3 months, I was prepping my phone books and I was baking them. So that is the way.
Just say that again for people you were baking
them. Them in the oven.
It's something you learned from an old magic book or something that said if you bake a phone book in the oven, the pages become brittle.
Yes.
And therefore easy to rip.
Right.
However,
as I started baking batches of telephone books, I realized there were lots of problems that come with that. You basically cook them like ribs. You cook them really low and slow for a very long amount of time. So after about 15, 20 minutes, the glue on the binding gets loose. And I found that if you just go ahead and cook the book as is, the cover is going to get charred and black and burned holes, which nobody's going to believe that that's a real phone book. So after about 15, 20 minutes, I start removing the cover. And then I, on cookie sheets, go ahead and put all the rest of the pages in. And you cook the pages for about 4 to 6 hours.
During which time your apartment smells like the Yellow Pages.
Oh, God. I'm pretty sure I got cancer. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that just seeped into my lungs and never, ever left. And it smells horrible the whole time. You're just going, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And so after about 4 or 6 hours, you pull all the pages out, and they're brittle. And you take a bunch of rubber cement, and you glue all these miscellaneous pages back together inside the outside cover of the phone book.
Which hasn't been in the oven, so the outside cover looks normal.
So the outside cover looks normal. But the problem is, at this point, you can't show it to anybody, because if they touch it, the pages are going to crumble.
Right. So you can't riffle through the pages as you would expect.
Right. It's extremely problematic to go, I'm going to rip this phone book. Nobody touch it. Nobody touch it. Right. And then, so I started
baking
them less.
But that is what you did. That is what you did. This was how you
finished. Well, I started baking them less. Once I realized, I did a few practice ones, and once I realized that this was going to be a problem, I started baking them less so that I would be able to hand it to somebody, at least keep one hand on it and give the other hand to another person so that they could check it a little bit. And I did this day, but the truth is it didn't help at all. And it took me about 10 minutes to rip through this telephone book, at which point everybody started feeling really, really bad for me and leaving. I keep trying to come up with jokes, and of course I don't have any cover lines. I expect this to go miraculously good. And
the whole show should have been 10 minutes. And this is taking 10 minutes just to do this.
This is taking 10 minutes, and so I just keep sweating and grunting, and my forearms are throbbing. I can't feel my fingers anymore. My fingernails on my thumbs are just, they feel like they're about to start bleeding, and I just can't give up. By the end of the show, there are only three people who are left watching. About one of them was the guy with egg on his jacket, yeah. His friend, and then some other miscellaneous bystanders who probably had come up just at the end. I couldn't rip through the whole thing. I started ripping through it about 100 or 200 pages at a time. And by the end, I threw the last bit down and I said, well, I think this phone book has been properly annihilated. And then I really just wanted to run away. I really just wanted to dive into the trash bins. But I knew that I would not have finished an actual show if I didn't collect money. And so I said, if you think what I've done is worth anything at all.
So not pitching it very high.
No, really not a lot of hope. Yeah. And if you think what I've done is worth anything at all, please come forward and put some money in my hat. Thank you.
And do you remember how much you made? Given that there are only three people in the audience, I'm guessing it's not a big thing.
I think I made like $3.15.
That's good. Somebody gave more than a dollar. That's $1.05 average.
And that poor guy had his coat ruined.
Yeah, it cost him more on dry cleaning.
That was my first show. So I think the fact that I got out the very next weekend is a miracle.
But so how long was it before you went, maybe I should just learn how to do these things rather than...
Pretty much right after that. But the truth was, it took me a long time, about 6 months, between thinking it was a good idea to really hanker down and start working on ripping phone books, between when I could actually do it.
Because it's not like magic, say, or juggling, where you can go to a magic shop or you can go to a juggling workshop. It's not like there's a lot of people around who you could even ask, how do I do this for you?
No, and that's what became one of the biggest difficulties in my first couple of years, was the fact that there are no other strong women. It was a blessing at the beginning to have found something that no one else was doing, that I could be the only person performing this type of show. But it also became a hindrance too, because there were no mentors. There was no one who I could ask questions to. There were no kind of set formulas for what would work on the street.
But so, that can only be good, can't it? Only be good.
In the long run, it's absolutely good. But what I found was, being a strong woman is a really interesting social dynamic. That being a woman on the street is one thing, but to stand up in front and say, I'm going to be stronger than all the men here, and to kind of challenge masculinity in that way, was a completely different task that I had to figure out the hard way.
So presumably when you started, were you the only woman working on the pitch?
For the most part, I was the only woman on pitch. And then one other gal became a girlfriend and then started doing street shows as well. So she was just as new as I was. We were both floundering in the same kind of way, trying out different things. But it probably wasn't until I started going to some festivals and just watching that I actually saw a woman work a street show.
And who was that? Do you remember who the first woman you saw?
I know who the first woman I saw was. Louise doing Pandora Pink. I saw her very, very briefly at the Toronto Buskers Festival.
Right, right.
And then after that, the first woman I saw was Shirley Sunflower. So what I was seeing were that women did big costumes, big character, and then had to have decent tricks on top of that. So I think really maybe that's a bit why Mama Lou became as big and character-driven as she did. I mean, possibly. I think that's always who I've been. Coming from a clown background, it's always way more about situational humor for me. I mean, because I'm from a more Lecoq-based and Native American-style clown. It's not a Ringling gag-based kind of thing. So to me, that's always been far more interesting than having these yuck-yuck moments. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I wonder if I pull some of that character-based stuff just from the women that I've seen. I'm not sure. I've never focused on what the girls were doing very much, because I think in a detrimental way, I was so stubborn, I wanted to be as good as the best guy. Which meant then that I kind of self-imposed this hardness, the way the guys do it. And it took me a really, really long time before I stopped and said, you know, you don't have to be good in their world, in their realm. You can be amazing and different but equally as amazing, just by being yourself, by being the type of personality that you want to be out there. You don't have to have kissing jokes and make sex jokes and be, you know, hardcore. You can just be lovely up there.
But there does seem to be, I'm generalizing, of course, but there does seem to be with women street performers, you know, either I'm looking for a man or I'm looking for love. Mm-hmm. Or, and I've always been amazed because quite quickly it's become its own cliche. Because at the beginning, I guess women were going, well, men always get women out from the audience, so I'll get men out from the audience. But then it seemed like an awful lot of women were getting men out from the audience and going, could you be my husband type thing?
Mm-hmm.
So you made that decision to not do that, to go the opposite way.
Yeah. I think, just to be totally honest, I did try that, but it just didn't feel right to me. It didn't feel honest. And that was one really big thing. I never wanted to be a chick street performer. I just wanted to be a street performer. And so it's really important to me now that, especially in the last few years, I don't do the love thing. I really try to keep it just about creating a funny scenario that doesn't have to be about finding a husband. But I've seen it. I know what you mean. I think it's safe for the people in the audience. Kristen Anderberg wrote this interesting little article that I read when I was very, very first starting. And I looked for it online and I can't find it anymore, but I've always kept this in my head because it was so fascinating. And she said, one of the things that you're going to battle as a female street performer that males don't have to even think about is that for a male to go around and be a vagabond from city to city and kind of have this flirtatious, charismatic air to him is understood in our culture. Men do that, and so it's not a danger. And there's the joke, oh, if you don't give me enough money to move to the next town, I'm going to have to stay and marry one of your daughters. Ha 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 ha. But for a woman to be in that same position, she's a danger, because now here's a woman who doesn't have a man who owns her making money, and the perception is that she's a danger to all the married women out there. And so I think that's a possible explanation to why, if you go out on the street and you know you're going to be asking for money, if you set up a scenario where you're looking for a husband, then that's acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, I always think, as a woman on the street, or performing anyway, it's not just about the street, but I always think, to a large extent, a lot of the women in the audience really want you to succeed.
I think they do, but there's a danger of coming across as too sexy, as too... Because if the guys want to stop and oogle you, then the women don't want to stop and watch. And there's a theory that women hold the purses. So you've got to make sure that the women are on your side if you want to get any cash in your hat at the end.
Right.
So it's a balance, because you're right. The women do want to love you and they want you to succeed, but they also don't want you to cross any societal boundaries.
They don't want to feel challenged by you.
Well, yeah, exactly. So it's an odd place to be, to find that balance. But one thing I think is a really big danger is playing towards the female stereotypes and using sex, even if you think it's in a funny way, using sex to draw your crowd.
It is disturbing, because you can see the guys in the audience who are watching are just going,
she's allowing me to look at her
in
that way.
She wants
you just
me
give
to,
him permission.
She actively wants people to stop and look at me,
yeah.
You know, with my legs over my head. And yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah. You know, every woman can go out there and do whatever you want to do.
Of
and
course.
Go make money any way you can. God bless you. Go do it. But to me, I couldn't. I just couldn't be so simple and so cheap. I feel like I'd be selling out the legitimacy of women on the street.
Okay, so you had this act now, and the act was legitimate things, not gimmick things. So you learned how to rip a phone book in half,
mm-hmm.
and you learned how to bend metal bars and stuff. But it's still a big leap between that and having a show that works.
Oh,
it?
God, yeah, that was like a 3-year leap.
Right.
One of the best things I remember was I read a lot of performers.net when I was starting out, because it was all the hugs that you ever needed, you know, all the advice and all the stuff, just saying, okay, so you're going to be a street performer. Basically, you're going to suck for a really long time.
Yeah, once you accept that you're going to be bad for a long time, it becomes easy.
I mean, you could feel like $1 million, and you can also feel like you should give up performing forever because no one should be subjected to your shit ever
in the
again.
In the same day.
In the same day, yeah. Once you just get comfortable with that and it doesn't define who you are, as long as you define yourself as a person who keeps waking up and going back out there, you're fine. You're on your way. That's it. I've had this discussion. I ask people, how long do you think it takes to create a good original show? Because for the first year, you're hodgepodging together shit that's new and that you're creating in your brain, and then shit that you know will work, but you maybe don't like that much, and lines you've found here, lines you've created, and they don't work yet. You know, they're not funny. So it's a disaster being glued together.
But I think clearly there are a lot of people now who their only thing is, does it get a reaction? And they don't care if it's theirs or somebody else's, mm-hmm. or if it's literally just stolen lock, stock and barrel from somebody else. How did you approach that? Did you say to yourself, okay, I don't want to just be saying the same lines that all these people are saying and doing the same?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and again, performers.net helped me solidify that quite a bit. I realize that if this is an honorable profession, an honorable group of people to be joining the ranks of, there's nothing honorable in just stealing. I mean, you have to give back. You have to create something that advances the art form. And I always believed quite strongly in that. I mean, you say thank you to the people who came before you and provided you with structure, provided you with some lines that would work in this situation, or, you know, tons of heckler lines that you can get in your brain to kind of, at least you know you can handle shit. I mean, that's kind of what it's about, is you're free-falling anytime you're in your first year of starting a show. You go in that circle, and for about an hour, you're in free-fall mode. Your brain can't even catch up with where you're supposed to be and what you're doing. So you use these things that you can keep in your pocket to just give you some, like, what are those rock things, you know, on your toes to just catch into the rocks?
Oh, yeah, that's a good word. But I can't
what is that word?
They, it's like crampets. Or
they're crampets. Crampons.
Crampons. It was a mixture of crumpets and tampons.
crumpets and tampons
combined are crampons.
That's kind of how I felt about the first year of doing shows, was you're falling out of the tree and you're grabbing for branches as you're falling. And the only way to say thank you to those people who helped get you through is to let go of those branches and just learn how to fly. It was always very, very important to me to progress past that and to have a show where I could let anybody watch it and they would be able to say, that was all original stuff. That's great. I want the respect of my peers. Maybe that's silly, but it's important to me.
So how long do you think it took you before you kind of felt happy enough to go, okay, this is me now, and it's not a shadow of somebody else. It's not a reflection of somebody else.
I'd say it took me about 3 years before it started feeling like something I was in control of rather than it was in control of me. And then by 5 years, I felt like I actually have something that I can put in front of people. And with all earnestness go, I worked my ass off for this. This show, it may not be fantastic. And I still, you know, it's not fantastic. But it's full of honor. It's full of heart. And it's my life. And I've put a lot of sweat and tears and gumption into it, and I still know it's going to grow immeasurably, but at least I'm at this point, and I'm at the end of my 6th or 7th year, where I know it's mine.
But now you're doing progressively less street shows, right?
Yeah. Actually, when did I stop doing street shows? I mean, I just kind of needed a break. So I got kicked out of Canada, which sucked. And I moved to Seattle because I had a plane ticket that I had messed up on and I could just pay the change fee. And I had a list of cities that I could possibly move to. And basically I gave a pros and cons list. And I said, well, I know that you can busk in Seattle. I know they have public transportation and coffee. And
but I've never not clairvoyant coffee.
But not, I had a feeling maybe it was going to be clairvoyant coffee. So I was like, you know what? I've never had anybody said anything bad about Seattle, so here I go. And I literally bought a plane ticket, packed my stuff into two suitcases, got on an airplane, and got off in my new city and stayed at the Green Tortoise Hotel or hostel for 2.5 weeks while I found a place to live. And I busked on my second day being in Seattle.
Down on Pike Street.
No, because I had to wait until the Thursday to get a permit to work there. So I actually went to the mall and just started doing shows out there. But coming to the U.S. after being in Canada for so long, and I'd worked Toronto, and then my home pitch was in Montreal when I moved out to Montreal. Going to Seattle was just, God. I felt like I was starting from scratch. Not because I was starting from scratch, but because it's not the culture. Nobody understands it. I felt like I had to learn how to teach the people what they were seeing, how they needed to appreciate it. You know, you're not just teaching them that they should be giving you money. You're teaching them how to stop, enjoy a second, and clap. I mean, that was in itself a success. To cultivate a crowd of 50 or more felt like its own reward.
Just because there's less tradition of it in America than in Canada and in Europe.
Absolutely. They've never seen a show like that. They've seen buskers, but they've not seen these circle shows. So there was a lot of challenge that just came with the education of it. But at that point, I was making all of my money on the street back in Canada. And so now I needed to go to making all my money on the street in the U.S. And the money just wasn't there. So as soon as you start being hungry and bitter, and you start getting angry at the audiences, that's really the time when you just kind of need to stop for a little while. And I just realized there was way more anger coming out of me than there was happiness and joy. And that I just decided I was going to run myself into the ground and I'd quit for good. So I just kind of stopped. I just decided that I needed to put more time and energy into other stuff, into getting my show into other venues. Places where there's actually seats and people have decided they want to come and watch you.
So what did you do?
So what did I do? I started working at the circus school in Seattle at Sanka. I was art modeling. So that kind of brought in just enough money to pay the rent. So then when I wanted to busk, I could go busk. I mean, the other thing about Seattle is it's so rainy all the time. So as somebody who feels guilty not being out there on a Saturday, even if it's raining, because what if it stops for 15 minutes and I can pull off a show? Like, that'll make you a crabby busker right there. So then if it was a nice day, I could decide to go out. But I wasn't forced to go fight with the local buskers in Seattle and stand in line and, you know, just play the game. I just wanted to be in charge of it more than it was in charge of me. Because it's not freedom if you're not free from it, you know? So what did I do? I started sending out packets. I started putting together a press kit and, I don't know, coming up with big dreams. Like, that I wanted to be on David Letterman and other silly things. I want to be in a circus and go start working in Europe. So, I don't know, I just dreamed big. But after that, I don't know, I guess I sent out a whole bunch of press kits. And I started picking up some agents for some different things, and I started trying my hardest to work in the U.S. because up until that point, I'd bounced all over the world, and I realized if you live everywhere, you actually live nowhere. And I was getting passed up for stuff that was local because nobody ever thought I was in town. So I kind of made this decision that if so many people would love to work in the United States, why am I running away and trying my hardest to get work permits to work everywhere else when there's probably lots of money to be made in this country? So I just decided I was going to stick to it and see what I could make happen and not be ungrateful.
And so now, the majority of your work is what?
So now, it turns out that I've been doing college gigs, cruise ships, and state and smaller fairs. And that's been a large part of what keeps me gainfully employed. And it's nice. It's nice to know that that's taken care of. And then whenever it's a fantastic day, whenever I'm in a beautiful location, I can still go out and busk. But it doesn't have to be what puts food on my table.
Yeah.
God bless the people who do that. God bless them. I always felt really jealous, though, not coming from a city where that is. You know, what I actually realized is a lot of the people who are professional buskers, they were born in a place like that. That's their home. They don't actually want to leave, whether it's Toronto or whether it's Sydney or Melbourne or something like that. Those people live there. And it's possible to go do that every day. Gosh, the people down in Key West or, you know, in New Orleans. But for me, I always had to travel to go work in another city. So it was always a big cost just getting there. It wasn't just, you know, the day to day. So I think that's a bit different. If you come from Kansas City, there's not a lot of, you don't just go home and stay at your friend's house and until finances start looking a little bit better. You just don't. That's always been one of those things. Whenever shit's hit the fan and money's gotten tight and you don't know what you're going to do, your life's falling apart, going home was never an option. I think that has been good for me because it's not an option. You can't fail. You just fucking pull your bootstraps up and figure it out and you'll be fine. But yeah, I've never been able to just go home.
So what do you think the actual things, what are the tangible things that you think you gain from work in the street that you use every time you perform?
I think the most important thing that I learned by stepping off of the stage is that in order to have an actual performance, one that's alive and not fake or phoned in, is you have to be present. You have to be there with every single person around you. And they all have to be part of that experience. And there's something, I don't even know, there's got to be some kind of word for it. Being actively present for every single time you enter the stage. That's what I learned on the street. And then also just being ready for anything. Just knowing that everything can and will happen. And you kind of want that. And you go with it. And that's what makes you a good performer. Not feeling freaked out if somebody changes the game on you. Because you set up this game and you invite people to come and play with you. And I'm not even talking just as a volunteer situation. By being present and looking at people and asking them questions, and you're inviting people to play with you. So you just have to be ready for all of it. That's what it's about. Otherwise, if you're not present and the audience isn't present, then there's no performance that actually happened.
Of course. Thank you so much for talking to me, Lindsay Lindbergh.
Thank you, John Peter.
It's been a pleasure.
Ah, me too.
Stories from the Pitch is produced by the Busker Hall of Fame. Music for today's podcast was created by Lindsay Lindbergh with Apple's Logic Pro and is called Rockabilly Beats and Vera. Subscribe to this podcast via iTunes. Just go into the Music Store's podcast section and search for Stories from the Pitch. And while you're there, take a second and post a review. These reviews help with our rankings and visibility in iTunes. If you have musical tracks you'd like us to feature, happen to be a helpful web genius who could help us improve the Busker Hall of Fame website, or heck, just an opinionated busker with a salty mouth, we want to hear from you. Drop me a line at cbg@buskerhalloffame.com. We also have loads of additional content on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Busker Hall of Fame. Check out the plethora of shots of people wearing the Busker Hall of Fame t-shirts and consider picking one up for yourself. Proceeds from these t-shirts help to fund the ongoing costs of maintaining this project. Complete ordering information is available on the Busker Hall of Fame website. We're also continuing to collect stories for a commemorative episode for the late, great Robert Nelson, a.k.a. the Butterfly Man. If you have a story or a memory you'd like to share, call the Remembering the Butterfly hotline at 1-416-613-0003. With the mention of that phone number, I also wanted to let you know that based on a suggestion from Dave Southern in Cheshire, England, we've created a few ringtones of classic moments from various episodes. Visit the ringtone page on the Busker Hall of Fame website and download away. We're really interested to see if these things catch on, so do let us know what you think. There's a great moment during this episode's conversation when Lindsay describes the fact that audiences like her when she's sincere, earnest, and wholesome. So we thought we'd leave you with this thought.
Always say yes to the hard thing. There's been a number of times in my life where you're faced with options, and you could do the hard thing or you can do the easy thing. You can do the scary thing or you can do the safe thing. The doors that open when you're brave enough to do the hard thing are just valuable beyond measure. You actually learn who you are at that point.
On behalf of myself, co-producer Lindsay Lindbergh, John Feely, who conducted the interview, and the rest of the Busker Hall of Fame staff, we hope this finds you well. And as you perform for audiences around the world, please remember to use your superpowers for good. I'm David Aiken, the Checkerboard Guy. Thanks for listening.
I bet you can't do it again.